court calls the next case. It's People of the State of Colorado versus Spencer Clinton Smith, case number 2010-SC-747. Are both parties ready? I see you are. Thank you. We're set for half an hour argument, 15 minutes per side. Please indicate who you are and who you represent when you start your argument, and the appellant, the people in this case, will have to keep track of their time. And in addition, I think you both were here. We're using our iPads, or some of us are, to actually look at briefs and read the record and sometimes check Westlaw. We're not surfing, so please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Corel Spedigue, attorney registration 39208, and I represent the people or the petitioner in this matter. This case has been an evolution into understanding specifically how the probation statutes interact with the concept of pre-sentence confinement credit and the pre-sentence confinement credit statute specifically. The Court of Appeals decision here applied this court's prior cases of Castro v. District Court and People v. Johnson in holding that trial courts have the discretion to award either all pre-sentence confinement credit or deny all pre-sentence confinement credit when sentencing a defendant to a term in a county jail, and that the trial court here specifically abused its discretion by awarding only partial credit to the defendant towards his probation sentence. Because essentially, since the court decided that he should have had some credit, they were limited to awarding all or nothing, and therefore they should have awarded all. Now, the people respectfully disagree. The Court of Appeals failed to make a very significant distinction here. This was not a direct sentence to a county jail. This was a probation sentence. This is a probation sentence, and as a part of this rehabilitative process, there was a condition of probation imposing a short sentence, or imposing a short term in the county jail as a condition of his probation. Now, based on the characteristics of his sentence, the statutes governing that, the pre-sentence confinement credit statutes simply do not apply here. Nor is the sentencing court's discretion to award pre-sentence confinement credit to jail sentences limited to an all or nothing distinction, as the Court of Appeals opinion suggests here. When, as here, a sentence to probation is involved, there are simply no limitations on a sentencing court as to whether to award some, all, part. There are just no limitations.
Oh, it's total silence? Is that what you're saying? There's no guidance by the legislature?
I'm saying that the court can consider it, but they don't have to. And they certainly are not mandated.
Well, what statute do we look to say that they can consider it?
I'm sorry, that they can consider it?
Right.
Well, there's no statute. There's a purposeful omission here on the part of the legislature that says, essentially, it's up to the court what they want to do, because probation is a wholly separate and distinct sentencing alternative to sentences to incarceration, as is demonstrated by the structure of the statute itself. We have a sentencing court can sentence to probation, community correction, sentences to imprisonment, or sentences to jail. And as such, the sentencing statute is divided in such a way so that probation, part two, sentences to community corrections and or some sort of specialized restitution program in part three, sentences to incarceration, part four, sentences resulting from a misdemeanor or petty offense, part five. They're all very purposefully divided, one next to the other, and they all don't, because the pre-sentence confinement credit statutes are housed in parts four and five, they do not apply to part two. They are not a restriction on part two. They are meant to apply to sentences to incarceration.
In that sentencing scheme, is a judge ever required to give jail as part of a sentence to probation?
Are they ever required to? No, sir. It's within their discretion if they feel that it's appropriate for that particular offender's rehabilitation process, then up to 90 days is the maximum a court can impose as a condition of probation, but they certainly don't have to. Now, this court in People v. Flanagan reversed a court of appeals finding that the probation, being a purely statutory creation, was subject to the presumptive sentencing ranges of the incarceration statutes. And so essentially saying presumptive sentencing ranges that are housed in the incarceration statutes do not apply to probation. And this very court reasoned that the reason being that probation was in a wholly separate subpart. They were distinct, different subparts, neither one referring to the other as indicating any sort of limitation on a probation sentence. And also finding that the policy reasoning was persuasive because probation is primarily rehabilitative. Incarceration statutes are for the purpose of punishment. This court says that if the legislature's judgment concerning an appropriate term of punishment by imprisonment was intended to fix or is even related to the term of probation necessary to rehabilitate an offender. So there's no indication that the legislature, when it enacted the pre-sentence confinement credit statutes, that in any way was an intent by the legislature to somehow curtail a district court's ability to fashion the appropriate probation sentence for each offender.
Counsel, putting that to one side for a moment, what is your view of the purpose of pre-sentence confinement credit, even in the context of sentences to incarceration? What purpose does it serve at all?
Well, it's been held that the idea being an equity idea that, you know, an indigent offender who serves time prior to sentencing would then serve potentially a longer sentence than his wealthier counterpart because they would both be, you know, sentenced to, once sentence was imposed, they would both be subject to, you know, the presumptive sentencing ranges and then also have had this additional time prior to sentencing.
And given that, I recognize that that's been articulated in our case law. Is that the people's position, that that is, in fact, the purpose of pre-sentence confinement credit, or do the people take a different position? And the reason I ask that is, why does that not apply with equal logical force in the probation context, where, in fact, a condition of probation is a jail term?
And thank you for asking that question, Your Honor. I think the answer to that is no, the people do not concede that that is necessarily the purpose of the pre-sentence confinement credit statutes. As this court found in Norton, there's no case law, or there's no cite. The Schubert court didn't cite to any authority for that policy reasoning that it purported in that case. It could just as easily be, you know, taking away the discretion from the court. It could have been more of a fairness issue. It has been kind of generally accepted that that's the purpose. But I would say that the people are not prepared to concede that that is, in fact, the purpose behind the pre-sentence confinement credit statutes.
Well, assuming that it is derived from some basic fairness concept, why doesn't it apply with the same force in the probationary context, or do you rely simply on our say-so to the contrary in Castro?
No, not at all. I think the difference is that probation is for a wholly separate purpose. Probation, the purpose of probation is to rehabilitate an offender, to essentially give this person, this gift from the court to be reintegrated into society under the purview of the probation department and to fashion these conditions that, in a sense, assist this offender in reestablishing themselves in the community in a positive way, in a law-abiding, positive way. And so to the extent that a short jail term is a part of that rehabilitative process, and an important part, I would argue, because at that point there's, you know, a psychological difference once you've become a kind of a student of the court, that you are now a rehabilitated, or you're in the process of rehabilitation, that the court needs to have this you know, wide array of tools before it, and this shouldn't be limited in any way when, in fact, this offender applied for probation, asked for it, the court was, you know, induced to grant it in a particular case because of whatever mitigating circumstances were present, and the offender accepted it, you know, didn't reject that at the get-go. So there's also an element of choice in this regard, too. If they don't want to pursue probation, they don't have to. They can reject probation and pursue their pre-sentence confinement credit rights under a sentence to incarceration, whether it be under the felony pre-sentence confinement credit statute or the misdemeanor version.
And I guess you would agree, though, as well, that if probation were at some later point revoked and that offender were sentenced to a term of incarceration at that point, that pre-sentence confinement credit would apply?
Yes, Your Honor. So as soon as that offender is now sentenced either to jail, a direct sentence to jail, or to the Department of Corrections, both, either one of those pre-sentence confinement statutes would automatically invoke that offender's banked time, if you will. And in addition to, in this case, he would also get credit for the 30 days that he spent incarcerated as a condition of his probation. So all of that would then, you know, he would have a right to, and it would be a mandatory credit as soon as that trigger of a direct sentence to the DOC or to jail is imposed.
Thank you.
Now,
was there any articulation by the court of the jail time here, the basis, the reason for it in this particular case?
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, there was a pretty, the court essentially, this gentleman, this was seemed to be a young offender. He showed up to a friend's house to collect a debt and brought a shotgun with him. And the court found during the sentencing hearing that this was, you know, that while he wanted to give this particular offender probation, because this was a young man, he didn't want, you know, to immediately sentence this person to the DOC, but at the same time wanted this offender to recognize that, you know, attempting to settle a debt dispute by bringing a shotgun to the victim's house is not a way, you know, this is a very egregious way to settle, you know, a conflict, and that he needed to understand that that was absolutely not acceptable. And so to the extent that this court felt strongly that as a part of this rehabilitative process for this particular offender, that he needed to spend another 30 days in jail, this was a very important piece of his rehabilitative program. And so the record shows that the court was fully aware of the time that he spent prior to sentencing in pre-sentence confinement, but recognized that, you know, in addition to that, he needed another 30 days of punitive sanctions to understand the gravity of what his actions, you know, what he did was absolutely not acceptable in our society. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Court of Appeals holding here and why it's also incorrect. In addition to, basically, the Court of Appeals based their holding on a quote from People v. Johnson that states, a trial court has the discretion to give credit for pre-sentence confinement on a sentence to a county jail, but the court must exercise this discretion in a manner that furthers the goal of the pre-sentence confinement credit statute, that is, to ensure that the defendant receive full but not duplicative credit. Relying on this quote, the Court of Appeals held that a sentencing court's discretion when applying pre-sentence confinement to a jail term is limited to awarding either all or nothing. Now, for the various reasons I just discussed, the felony version of the pre-sentence confinement credit statute doesn't apply here. And the misdemeanor version also doesn't apply because this particular defendant was sentenced to a was being held for a felony, and this was the misdemeanor version only applies to misdemeanor offenses. So the court's reliance on Johnson, the issue in Johnson, the Court of Appeals in Johnson, with whether the Court of Appeals erred in concluding that the felony pre-sentence confinement credit statute required that pre-sentence confinement credit be applied only to a felony sentence. So this offender had both a felony sentence and a consecutive misdemeanor jail time sentence. And he started serving the jail sentence first and received 224 days of credit towards his jail sentence. Then, when he was transferred to the DOC, he said, this is where the 224 days should have been applied because this was my DOC sentence and that's where pre-sentence confinement credit applies. And this court found, no, you don't get duplicative credit. This case was all about duplicative credit. And so to the extent that he received his credit because he had a DOC sentence and that invoked the pre-sentence confinement credit statute, which therefore made it mandatory that he received that credit. But this court said it doesn't matter if you received it against your jail sentence or your DOC sentence. It just matters that you got it. You received full credit, and that's the purpose of this statute. And to the extent that this court, the Court of Appeals in this case, seemed to just take that little piece, the full credit part, and didn't really pay attention to the fact that this case was all about duplicative credit. And in fact, the Court of Appeals reasoning contradicts its own holding because the Court of Appeals also states that you could give no credit. So how is that, how is that reconciled against the idea that you receive only full credit? It seems counterintuitive that a court concerned with the equity would also allow that you can either give all or nothing. In this case, the court could have just as easily given nothing and sentenced the defendant to 90 days in prison, or in jail, had he wanted to, as a condition of probation. So I don't believe that that's what the legislature intended here. I think this is kind of a nuanced situation where we have a felony defendant with a jail term, but it was imposed as a condition of probation. And because probation is a completely, entirely different statute, an entirely different policy purpose behind it, it's completely separate and distinct. We cannot treat it the same. It should not be treated the same, and we should allow the court to have, you know, the full array of the tools before it in order to fashion the most effective rehabilitative program for each offender when this, you know, privilege is imposed and allowed to continue. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve my 8 seconds for rebuttal.
It's now 5.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument. Ms. Weiss.
May it please the court, my name is Dana Weiss, registration number 36656, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Smith. I first want to address that importantly, nowhere in the Colorado Revised Statutes has the legislature authorized trial courts to award partial credit for time spent in pre-sentence confinement, as the trial court did in this instance. It's not found in the probation context. It's not in the incarceration context. Nowhere has the legislature authorized partial credit. In fact, the only statutes to address pre-sentence confinement...
Wait. Would you say that again, Ms. Weiss?
Nowhere.
You're talking in the negative. You're confusing me.
No problem. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Nowhere has the legislature authorized trial courts to award partial credit.
Okay, I think I got it.
Excuse me.
But the probation statute sets the aggregate length or limit of a commitment, right? So that by definition implies we can have less than the limit, right?
That is correct.
So that's partial, right?
No, I'm referring, excuse me, let me clarify.
Oh, to DOC you're talking about?
I'm sorry?
You're talking about PSCC to DOC?
Correct.
Well, that doesn't involve this case because he didn't get sentenced. He got sentenced to probation.
That is correct, Your Honor. He was sentenced to probation. However, there's not a specific statute that authorizes a trial court to award partial credit when granting or awarding pre-sentence confinement credit for time spent incarcerated prior to imposition of the sentence.
Sure. Okay.
In this case, there are two pre-sentence confinement credit statutes, one in the felony context and one in the misdemeanor context.
Right. But you're not suggesting the judge did something he couldn't do. You're just saying his rationale was wrong in thinking he had to do it because of pre-sentence confinement credit. Is that right?
That is correct. I'm arguing that he was incorrect in awarding partial credit. And first and foremost, let me just state that the trial court in this instance did correctly apply existing case law by this court in concluding that trial courts do have discretion to award pre-sentence confinement credit when they're sentencing to a county jail sentence. However, once that discretion is authorized, or once that discretion is exercised, excuse me, they have to exercise it in a way that that grants full credit for time served incarcerated.
Well, wait a second. This is a probation case, so I don't get it. I mean, Justice Marquez asked, you know, the fundamental rationale is so that a poor person isn't going to serve more time in county jail because they can't make bond, right?
That's correct.
But that's not the purpose of probation. And the probation is, except for excluded offenses, the purpose of probation is whatever the judge thinks in her discretion will make sense so that that person return to society, right?
It is rehabilitative, correct. And
well,
judges are
so important. That's exactly what happened here in this case. And the limit to that is 90 days.
That is correct.
So he said, hey, you spent 89 days. That's not enough for what you did, you know. You don't take shotguns to collect debts.
Well, Your Honor, you do point out that there is discretion to impose probation and to impose different conditions of probation. Jail is one condition that courts can impose as a condition of probation. The legislature has said that a jail can impose only up to an aggregate of 90 days jail as a condition of probation. So courts do have that authority.
But it says the aggregate length of any commitment, whether continuous or a designated intervals, shall not exceed 90 days. That implies you can make them spend it on Wednesdays, on the weekends, whatever, right?
That's correct, but it can be an aggregate of 90 days. In this particular case...
Oh, it says not exceed. So
not
here he's saying, I'm going to give you 31 days, you know, whatever it is.
He could impose 30 days up to 90 days.
Right.
That's at sentencing. The court has the discretion to impose...
So why are we saying it's at his discretion, or why are we subtracting out the 89?
Basically, Your Honor, at this juncture, what the statutory interpretation that the state is urging this court to accept would allow the court to do what he did in this case, which is essentially attempt to impose a 119-day sentence. And that is contrary to the legislative intent expressed in the probationary context, which authorizes courts to impose up to 90 days. And going back to Justice Marquez's question regarding the purpose behind the pre-sentence confinement credit statutes, it is indeed, or it has been articulated by this court to be, or the purpose or the legislative intent behind enactment of the pre-sentence confinement credit statutes, to make sure that poor people are not treated differently than rich people. And the reason that this court articulated that purpose is because at the time, if people were not being granted the time that they had spent incarcerated prior to sentencing, they would ultimately serve longer sentences than their wealthier counterparts. The same holds true here. If an individual is sentenced to probation and they're facing a 90-day jail sentence as a condition of probation, a wealthier individual who is able to post bond immediately and has spent no time incarcerated prior to sentencing would be subject only up to 90 days. On the flip side to that, the defendant, as in this case, who has already spent 89 days, would be subject up to a total of 179 days total jail as a condition of probation. That unequal treatment between poor and the rich, or people who are able to post bail, is what the legislature sought to avoid in enacting the pre-sentence confinement credit statutes. And I would point out that this court announced that was the legislative intent and the purpose behind those statutes, not only in Schubert, but it was rearticulated in Massey, it was rearticulated in Johnson. And those cases, indeed, were decided closer in time to the enactment of the mandatory crediting provision or amendment to the pre-sentence confinement credit statute.
So let me get your argument. You're basically saying we should import the rationale on the pre-service credit statutes dealing with DOC to the probation statute, and that the reason for that is that a wealthy person who posted bond could only receive 90 days, whereas this man had to receive 100 and whatever it is, 29 or 130, right?
Absolutely. And Your Honor, that is
there because... anything else you can point to in terms of the discretionary matter that, because the statute's pretty clear, it's discretionary. On probation, I'm talking about.
That probation is discretionary and the term...
Well, we know that. But I mean, anything that supports your argument about the importing of the rationale that is expressed with respect to DOC sentences.
Yes, Your Honor. I would point to 18.1.3.104 of the Colorado Revised Statutes, and that specifically is the provision that grants trial courts the authority to impose sentencing alternatives, such as probation or community corrections. And it specifically and expressly makes imposition of an alternative sentence, such as probation, subject to the other provisions of Title 18. Contained within Title 18 are the mandatory pre-sentence confinement crediting provisions. And so this specific provision expressly incorporates the pre-sentence confinement credit provisions found in 18.1.3.405 and 18.1.3.509. And therefore, it makes any sentence to confinement subject to the pre-sentence confinement credit statutes. Additionally, I would note that the state cites to Beecroft a decision by this court on page 31 of their reply brief.
Can you I'm sorry to interrupt you. Could you just give me that cite? 18.1.3.041? Is that what you said?
Sorry, 18.1.3. 104. And it grants trial courts the discretion to impose sentencing alternatives such as probation, but explicitly makes them subject to the other provisions of Title 18. And so there was no need to enact a separate, given that the pre-sentence confinement credit statutes were made subject to or were made part of the probationary scheme in that way, they're adequately encompassed within the probationary statutes that are found in Part 2.
Well, what's your response to this argument that the credit isn't lost, it just isn't used, you know? He will enjoy it if he gets revoked, right? That's what I heard.
Correct. Well, I think that that's clear right now that if somebody is revoked on probation, they're entitled to any time spent incarcerated prior to imposition of a DOC sentence.
Yeah, and there can't be duplicative credit, right?
That's correct. But that still doesn't resolve the policy reasons or the legislative intent and the purpose behind the pre-sentence confinement credit statutes, which specifically by their plain language state that when somebody is incarcerated or sentenced to confinement, that they are to get credit for the time spent incarcerated prior to imposition of the sentence. The plain language of 18.1.3405, for example, does not distinguish between the different types of sentences. It just says, when a trial court sentences somebody to to confinement, that they are entitled to receive credit for time that they spent incarcerated prior. Based on that plain language, trial courts have to grant that credit. And I think the legislative intent by using that language is clear. So the purpose behind that statute applies with equal force, and again, as articulated by this court in Schubert and Massey and Johnson, to prevent the unequal treatment of indigent defenders from their wealthier counterparts. I would also note that in Beecroft, this court did articulate in determining the issue in Beecroft essentially was that whether a participation in a rehabilitation program constituted confinement when it was imposed as a sentence or a condition of probation. And what this court did was announce that any sentence, and again, not addressing the specific instance or the specific facts that we have here, but it did announce that any time spent in jail or a DOC facility constitutes confinement for purposes of the pre-sentence confinement credit statutes. So because this court recognized that a sentence to confinement is different from a condition, for example, or a restriction, for example, that may be imposed on probation. Normally, and I would note that the state cites in their brief to various restrictions, such as area restrictions, association restrictions, all of these are normal restrictions that may be imposed in the probationary context, but all of these are also very much distinguishable to a sentence to jail, which is what was imposed here. Once somebody is sentenced to confinement, it implicates the pre-sentence confinement credit statutes, which by on their face state that any sentence to confinement, when somebody is sentenced to confinement, they are entitled to the time that they spent incarcerated prior to that sentence.
Can I just change your focus a tiny little bit? I'm not sure whether my mic is on or not. Are you hearing me okay?
I can, thank
okay,
you.
Thank you. Let's say I agree with the second part of your argument, the second part of the Court of Appeals decision. The way I'm understanding your argument is that you're not disagreeing or asking us to disagree with the first part of the Court of Appeals decision, which is kind of a predicate. That is that there is discretion in the first place whether to give pre-sentence confinement, but assuming that you exercise discretion, you have to give it all. So can you speak to that first point, please?
Let me just clarify that first and foremost, we are asking the court to affirm the Colorado Court of Appeals opinion in this case. But it is somewhat, if the court is going to address the larger question, that's when you get into the legislative intent and the purpose and applying Massey and Schubert and Johnson. However, the Court of Appeals in this case did correctly apply this court's prior cases. In Castro, for example, this court did resolve the question. This is an early 1980s case. It basically interpreted the pre-sentence confinement credit statute 18.1.3405 and said that pre-sentence confinement credit, while it has to be awarded when sentencing a defendant to the DOC, does not have to be awarded when sentencing a defendant to a county jail sentence. And that case still is out there and exists.
That's kind of what causes the problem, because if you don't have to actually award it, then why does it follow that if you choose to do so, you have to award all of it? Isn't that kind of the dilemma here?
Well, it applied Castro for that first proposition, which is that it's discretionary when awarding it to a county jail. Let's say that the legislature has since enacted in 2007 the pre-sentence confinement credit statute, making it mandatory when sentencing to a county jail. But the second part that the court applied was this court's holding in Johnson. And in Johnson, this court announced that once the credit is awarded, that, well, essentially it articulated the purpose behind the pre-sentence confinement credits statutes was to ensure that people receive full credit for the amount of time that they spent incarcerated. So it applied those two cases in conjunction.
Sure. Would you be asking us, you're not asking us to overrule Castro?
Your Honor, I think that, I think at this point Castro could very well be addressed. And I do think that consistent with Schubert, Massey, and Johnson, that it would make sense to make sure that pre-sentence confinement credit is mandatory in all contexts to avoid the equal protection problems and the unequal treatment of indigent defenders that was the purpose and the intent behind the legislature in the first place.
Well, not to put you on the spot, though, then why don't you want us to just go that extra yard and overrule?
In this case, and I see that my time is up.
You please answer the question.
In this case, Your Honor, I think that as it applies to Mr. Smith's case, the Court of Appeals correctly applied existing case law, and you don't even need to get to that question in the context of this particular case. So if I may conclude with asking the court to please affirm the Court of Appeals decision or otherwise find that pre-sentence confinement credit applies in this context.
Thank you. Ms. Pettigrew, you have a few seconds. We'll let you go. Unless there weren't any other questions, were there, Ms. Feist? So we'll give you a few extra.
Very briefly, I'd just like to leave the court with the idea that, again, probation is a privilege. The offender has a choice in probation, and they can either choose to reject it, and at that point, they can exercise, you know, their ability to, or their right to all of their pre-sentence confinement credit. And that's all my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to thank both attorneys for your arguments. The case will be submitted on